You're listening to the 405 Exchange Podcast. My name is Kent Grandpierre, and today's episode is with David Keenan. It feels pretentious to say it, but the only way to describe today's guest would be artist. David Keenan is a musician from Ireland that infuses a love of poetry and visual art into everything that he does. I was first put onto his music about 3 years back, and I was immediately struck by how all-engrossing his art tends to be. I always say it on this podcast, but the people I admire the most are the people who can be themselves regardless of what room they're in, and David is that in fucking spades. This talk was a long time coming, and I'm really glad we're able to make it happen. He was in town for a residency at the incredible Irish Arts Center here in New York, and on this episode, we go into his early days, the work that's gone into his upcoming album, A Beginner's Guide to Bravery, which is out on January 10th, and why he's grown to love New York so much. This is the 405 Exchange with David Keenan. Enjoy. Left me old before my time. So I'm writing this installment on a sick back just for you, in the hope that in the process I might conjure up a few scenarios for an old ghost. Wanna rain dressed in your clothes? Come over here, you fucked up news. Read me so soon and have your head on. So it's pretty wild to me that this is like our first time getting the chance to meet, because funnily enough, for as long as I've known about you and your music, which I want to say has been like the last 3 years or so, you have been in New York so many times, and somehow I keep missing you. I feel like from what I could garner from that, obviously like being in New York makes sense from like a business perspective, but I feel with the amount of times you come here, in some ways it's probably grown to being a second home for you. Would you agree with that?
Well, I certainly feel very much at home here, but over the last 3 years, it's kind of, it's been, I suppose, in terms of America, it's been an anchorage and a kind of a place where I could lay low for a couple of days, and there's kind of a group, kind of a tribe has kind of grown in the last couple of years here, and people who have acted as patrons and supporters and friends, you know. So just to be here, I've written a number of songs here, so I do feel a sense of liberation when I can walk the streets. And you know, the first time that I came to America, I landed in Brooklyn, and then I had a few days afterwards around the city, and you know, like that first experience, kind of an Alice in Wonderland, or that was the kind of experience that I had. So yeah, I love it here, and as I said, it's good to put down roots in a place like this and watch them kind of spread, you know.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And imagine if, like, for an artist like you, it's like one of the most amazing things about this place is that, I mean, you get this in a lot of major cities, but I feel like in New York it's very succinct in how specific it is. But the way that your your proximity to people is so intense in a positive way, where it's like you have no choice but to interact with people on a day-to-day basis.
Well, it's a relentless place in every which way, and that kind of suits me as well for periods of time, for a week or two, you know, because I find myself being quite relentless in my personality and you know, in my writing. So at a place like this, the pace of it, it really just lends itself to my writings. And every scene, you know, you're walking the streets and every scene kind of tops the last in terms of absurdity and wonderment and you know, like, as I said, rootlessness almost as well, you know. It's got it all, the city.
It really does. I want to explore that relentlessness, because to describe your music, to describe the way you perform and how much the music is in that form of feeling, it honestly is indescribable. Like, something that's been a true pleasure getting to know your music and enjoying what you do is recognizing that, like, there's times where I can't describe it.
I think the music is a byproduct of my personality, and the music is kind of the end result of a particular kind of mode of thinking or feeling that you're kind of you're living in and you're stewing in, you know. But I think the artists that I always kind of found resonance in what they were doing was it's all about, I suppose, honesty and believability, you know. So I want to kind of see somebody who's you know, who's really singing a song because it's life or death, you know, and it's there's no half measures, and you don't feel like you're being cheated out of anything, and you kind of have the for me it's a kind of survival thing, you know, the secondary world that I've been kind of exploring through the kind of art of songwriting, or, you know, going on these trips in the imagination. It's always been a mode of escapism that I kind of discovered as a child, you know. So trying to build that secondary world and trying to open the door and invite people in. I was thinking about it today, actually, and I think it's all about just the pursuit of this thing, the pursuit of a vision, or the pursuit of trying to. For me as a kid and as a younger man, as a teenager, I was trying to transcend mediocrity, because in the sense of within myself, you know what I mean, that sense of mediocrity was probably as a result of my insecurities or whatever, but I wanted to kind of transcend whatever this normality was, to get to a higher kind of plane of existence. And I always kind of I found I could tap into that through imagination and through song, and through the act of channeling that song and becoming a character in that song. You know, it's kind of, you're stepping out of the parameters of who you are, who people think you are, you know, and then you start making your way towards your true self, or whatever you perceive that to be. I suppose it's that kind of transcendent nature of art, you know. And I kind of copped that as a young man and thought, okay, well, I'm going to pursue this, you know, because I suppose growing up, I was growing up in a small town. It was a grey enough experience, and I just, as I said, I escaped to this kind of secondary world through music and art and voices and imagination and these kind of characters that were standing by their truth and you know, these amazing artists that were sculpting their worlds, and I wanted to try my hand at sculpting my own, you know, and to see what kind of journey it would take me on. And that was more appealing to me than going to college or you know, like getting an office job, or, you know, there was never really a choice, you know. Once I kind of made that discovery, it was always going to be one thing, you know.
Yeah. Well, when you said that element about life and death, it makes so much sense to me, because seeing like your music videos, seeing videos you performing live, I haven't had the chance to see you live yet. I'm going to tomorrow, I believe. And what's wild to me is just like everything I've seen of you really exhumes that, where it's very much like, I mean, you say that bit there at the end about how you never wanted an office job, and I see you perform like, well, good, because I could never imagine you being in one.
No, imagine.
Yeah, but tell me this, like,
you'd be sectioned, you know.
Exactly. Well, you kind of brought it up, but I kind of want to explore it a little bit more of you. What were you like in your youth? Like, was art always at the focal of everything for you?
Well, it just seemed like this kind of this mentor that I always leaned on, and kind of the words and melody and art and poetry, it was always the safety ropes that kind of pulled me out of the bog again and again and again, you know. And again, I kind of recognize a sense of transcendence in, you know, in poetry or in art, and just the sheer kind of exhilaration of tapping into my imagination, or playing a gig, you know. So that was like, it was like a vote, you know. There was never really a choice. I mean, I feel blessed in a sense that that I clung to it, and I kind of protected that candle, you know, I suppose, of individuality, because we are so unselfconscious as children, and then society kind of tries to dampen that, you know, and through schooling, and a lot of kids just do not survive, you know, and the kind of know, the kids whose dreams died in fifth class, you know, it's that kind of thing where it's, you can have that dream kind of eradicated by, you know, negativity or kind of this whole concept of talent. I don't think it exists. I think, well, talent isn't a real thing. I believe talent is like a criteria that is put on kids in school.
Well, that's interesting. Sorry, I don't mean to cut you off. It's just that I feel like many people would find you to be talented.
Well, I don't know what talented means, you see. I think this whole notion of talented, or, you know, a talent, I think it smothers a lot of kids' dreams. And you know, like, what is defined, you know, you can be talented in school having a kind of an aptitude for memory, you know, for exams. But the kid in the corner who's painting or sketching or, I mean, say where I grew up anyway, I'm sure there's progressive schools that are kind of very encouraging with art and expression or imagination or storytelling or comedy. I think talent is kind of this kind of notion that kind of holds more people back and maybe gives people false hopes as well, you know. I think it's about graft with a father, you know, graft, you know, graft, and the pursuit of that, and the relentless pursuit of this kind of vocation or vision that you have for yourself or notion that you have of yourself in life, whatever's going to fulfill you. For me, I never really had the confidence in myself to really kind of apply myself in school. I wasn't interested because, you know, the teachers weren't inspiring at all. And I think a lot of them were just burnt out. So, you know, it's. I think that's, you know, again, I'm incredibly happy with how everything kind of turned out for me. I think if I had been wrapped in cotton wool, or if I had have maybe went to study music in college, things might have been different. I had to go my way. That was just my story, you know. Everybody's story is different. But for me, getting back to being a teenager or a young kid, I just wanted to pursue this thing and to be a songwriter and to be a writer and to kind of all my energies went into that, you know, and going on this kind of journey or getting lost in some kind of unholy war, you know, these kind of romantic notions you have as a young man, you know.
Yeah.
That's what I was kind of pursuing, that's what I was seeing, and so I had to go on a journey within and without to kind of explore all those kind of possibilities, you know.
Well, that's amazing to me. I'm really curious to hearing about the story behind your upcoming debut album, A Beginner's Guide to Bravery. Amazing title, by the way.
Thank you.
When did you begin to realize that the songs you were writing were leading towards your first proper album? Because I think what's interesting with you, for people listening who might not be familiar with you, with the way you've put music out, it's very clear to me that you very much love the aspect of writing something and there being no barrier or time, but like a lot of time going between releasing something, where you like the fact that you could like do that as an artist. Yeah. So you're always writing, I would assess from that. So when did you realize that these songs were leading towards an actual album?
Well, you know, I kind of shoot from the hip a lot, I've kind of tried to get better at maybe editing things, but I think you have to trust your initial gut feeling as well, and always go by that. And, I went through a process a couple of years ago, of, you know, working with a producer, and then that didn't work out, and I became kind of frustrated that I had no kind of output, really, and all the kind of all the writing that I was doing, you know, on the side, but yet I have no output, and you need to kind of put something out or at least document it so you can move on. So after that experience, I started releasing, you know, the Strip Me Bare EPs, and that was literally just one mic and an evening in a friend's home, and I said, well, there's something about these recordings, so I want to put them out, and that's of its time. But all the while building towards the album, and you know, there's been times in the last couple of years where I truly believed that I was ready to put out the record, but the universe was conspiring against me, and it was telling me, you're not ready, you know, you're not ready yet. I think I got to a point where 25, and I said, I have this collection of songs, I can feel myself kind of going beyond this sound kind of very soon, you know?
Yeah.
And I need to document this and put it out. And then luckily everything kind of aligned. But I mean, one of the songs on the record came, you know, the record was recorded in a week.
Was it?
It was recorded 5 days. And then I wrote this song, The Healing. And 2 months later, we went back in over 2 days and recorded The Healing. And I recorded James Dean. And we recorded we recorded 3 songs then in 2 days. It's all live. There's very little overdubs. My whole concept going in here was life isn't click tracked, and I want this to be a representation of these bodies in a room. You press record, you open the door, and you allow reality to do its thing,
yeah.
And to capture that energy, you know, to try to bottle it anyway. And I feel like we achieved it, you know, and yeah. That's how the record came about, but it was done very quickly, and that's kind of like I kind of like to work like that. Though recently I've started to kind of do a bit more chiseling and take my time just to see what happens, you know.
Yeah.
But again, I the process behind this record was as it should have been, and I'm very proud of it. You know, I really am.
Well, that's a beautiful thing. I hope this doesn't sound reductive at all, but the way you were describing that, like capturing that live essence. Throughout my years, I feel like that's a method of thought and a method of approach that I see very prevalent within your home country and the musicians from your home country. Like, it feels like there's almost an innate sense that that's kind of the way to go about things when it comes to recording music.
Mm.
Do I sound far off in that, or is that something you feel like you recognize as well with some of your peers or even some of the musicians from your country that you've enjoyed over the years?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the analog ways of recording, and it's kind of, it's more, I just find it more kind of, again, honest, you know. And and I've had experiences with when it's it depends what you're trying to achieve and what you're trying to say, but I've had experiences with both, and I know which kind of what speaks to me in a more kind of like, all right, this is more honest. I feel like I was there, you feel like you're in the room. It's more of an experiential thing, whereas you know, something can sound incredibly polished but almost too perfect to be kind of, you know, it can be kind of inaccessible for me, for my own personal taste. But I
yeah.
think yeah I think in general in music and in art and in topics of conversation and social issues, we're all craving just truth and a deeper sense of truth and honesty. And I think live recording or in the studio is just a byproduct of that as well.
No, it's very important that where did you make the majority of the album? Because you're here a lot. Like, did you do you have done some of the writing, I imagine, here, but did you do some of the recording, or was it all done in Ireland?
It was done in the Hellfire Club in the Dublin Mountains, which is an interesting spot if you kind of know the story of the place. But
I actually don't. I don't think a lot of our listeners do either, so feel free to share.
Well, the Hellfire Club was this kind of this spot in the Dublin Mountains, which was kind of commandeered by these kind of these bousies back in the 1700s, let's say, kind of aristocrats who would go there and play cards with the devil and stuff like that.
Oh, okay.
And it's notoriously haunted, and there's been strange happenings there. So the studio was literally, you know, a stone's throw from that actual site, and you can see Dublin City just, you know, pulsing at night. The lights, it's the best view of Dublin, you know. And it's an old farmhouse, and I recorded it there with Gavin Glass and Gavin played guitar in the band. So we spent 5 days there in May, and then we went back again in August for 2 days, and we finished it.
What I get from talking to you is I feel like anyone who grew up with you or any of your family members who are like listening are probably like, yeah, that's David. It makes sense he would go to the Hellfire Club to make an album.
Well, yeah, there you go. Appealing to the aesthetic again, you know. But no, it's just Gavin just happened to be there, and it, you know, when I moved to Dublin, I used to go up to that site quite a lot, and you know, we used to shoot some things there, myself and my friend Rob Benson, and I'm a kind of a vibe merchant, you know, so I kind of pick up on things like that. So it was perfect for me. I was living in Dublin at the time, and all the band are from Dublin, so it was great to be there and to you know, in that old farmhouse and just channeling, you know, and it was incredible.
I'm kind of miffed that none of my Dublin friends have taken me there now. I wonder, is it like one of those places where typically people try to avoid, or?
No, it's a beautiful kind of hike up to it, the Dublin Mountains, and yeah, you should go there. Yeah. The roof was blown off, I think.
I'm back in Dublin in December, I should try to get
you
there.
You should go there, yeah. There's some stories you should read up about that place. You know.
Yeah, definitely will. A few nights back, I saw the video that you did for Tin Pan Alley, and it was one of those instances where I feel like a video is perfectly encompassing what a song is about, essentially, like, the characteristics of the song, like, the feeling and, like, the imagery that a song could convey. I feel like you really nailed that with that video. I want to both explore the song and the video for you. I'm curious, how did your way of singing inform how you wrote this one? Because I'm always captivated by songs where it feels like the singing is directing how the writing. Was that the case with this one?
Well, that's an interesting kind of footnote for the album, because just a bit of trivia. Tin Pan Alley was recorded in the initial session, and we went back over those 2 days to shoot that video. But the clip that you see is the first take of the video, and it's the first. So we just took the audio and we said, well, this is better than the actual original. So it went on the album. So what you're hearing there is the actual album version of the song. And that's the first take that Rob Benson captured, me and Harry. But it just goes, the synchronicity between me and Harry, because I kind of blink and he starts playing, you know, as if we're kind of hooked up to the same wire or something. It's amazing, you know. But I wrote that in London a couple of years ago, and it wasn't directed by the singing at all, because I wrote it on the guitar, and I was writing very, very, very in very hushed kind of tones, because my housemate was constantly giving out to me about playing the guitar late at night, and I, of course, like, you know, it'd be a full moon, and I'd kind of be wired, and I'd need to stay up playing, like, trying to write.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say that singing informed it, but certainly, you know, the singing is, my voice certainly changed in the last couple of years, and I suppose it's just trying to get a grasp of it, and you know, those things you pick up, you know, just how to breathe properly and things like that. But that was in the Hellfire Club as well, actually, that video. That's in the studio that we recorded.
Oh, is it?
So that room is where we recorded the album, and we were kind of like, well, we've only got 2 days to record 3 songs and a video, so okay, well, so it was all, that's the pace of everything at the record. But it all seems to come together, you know?
It does. I should set the scene for people who might not have seen the video. I highly recommend it. It's a beautiful video, but it's wild to think that's the studio, because it almost kind of looks like a cave.
Well, that's it. It's all exposed stone, and that's all that kind of stone of from around the area, the old farmhouse, the mountain, same kind of stone in the Hellfire Club itself. You know?
That's so brilliant.
Yeah, we were kind of entombed in this kind of place, you know.
I feel like Alter Wine is a damn fine achievement of a song. That's one of those songs you should definitely be proud of.
Thank you.
Yeah. There's so much to be proud of here, and tell me about the evolution of this song, because I'm curious how close of what we hear is what you had originally imagined and envisioned for this song.
Yeah. Well, I wrote that again. I wrote it in London, and there's an original version of it up on Spotify, which is just me and the piano. I can't play the piano, but I could play a couple of chords, and that's how I wrote it. And that was a kind of a channeling, really, of you know, it was actually, the song came about after falling in love for the first time with this person, and it was just initial contact, yeah, I kind of saw it as this kind of conjuring up of this kind of muse figure in my life that I'd always kind of hoped for, you know, and here I was kind of having these initial kind of interactions with her, and it just literally came from a conversation, and that set the flame, you know, set the spark, and yeah, I'm just like my mother, she sighed, only she hides it better. That was a line that was said, and next of all, I remember running back to the studio and putting one of these sick bags out on the floor that I had collected from the planes going back and forth to London, and I was scribbling on them, and I'd just written, the nine muses, you know, Erato, and I had them on one of the sick bags, and then the song just came. But what I was seeing was kind of this muse, this young woman expressing all her kind of repressed kind of sexuality and trauma and femininity, you know, and kind of this seance kind of scene, and her in an anarchist kind of fashion, you know, dancing fucking on an altar with a bottle of altar wine, maybe getting back at that institution, maybe getting back at something, but with something to prove. And you know, literally I was just sketching what I was seeing in my head of these scenes as they were playing out. But the video then was kind of an elaboration on that. And then I found during the process of making the music video, I kind of was channeling my own repressed kind of femininity, or growing up with that toxic masculinity thing, and not knowing what to do with, you know, being a sensitive young man, not knowing what to do, not knowing how to express it, living in rural Ireland, you know. And we went there, and then we went kind of with all ancestral trauma as well. So we covered a lot of bases with that one. With the video, and then myself in terms of the song. But that's the kind of things we explored. But the initial song was me really just seeing these vivid kind of images of this, all sparked, I suppose, by love, and then the kind of ideal of this person that you loved, you know, as this defiant kind of muse, you know.
Yeah. So. Does it usually feel that way for you, like in terms of music conjuring up imagery?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I see when I sit down and I write. I don't really hear any music. I mean, there's musicality in the words, but I'm not thinking of the song. I'm thinking of the actual scene, you know, and what it's like tracing. It's like tracing an image in reverse, you know, and it's like watching a short film in my head, and I'm trying to tie it all together with language. I'm trying to describe what I'm seeing in my head, you know. That's how the kind of songs come around, you know.
It's so wild talking to you, because I feel like I'm kind of having a bit of confirmation of what I assumed about you, in the sense that listening to your music and watching how you perform it, it's so clear to me that it's the only thing you could be doing, in terms of like, if you weren't like on a stage, or weren't on like a TV show, if you weren't touring in some way or fashion, you'd still be doing music, because you have to get it out of you.
Yeah, it's medicine. If I don't write for a few days, I start to unravel, you know, and that's just going by experience. It's like it's a part of it's like eating, you know. And I mean, it's something that I enjoy, you know. I really enjoy it. But I love putting the work in every day. I love it, you know. I love trying to go deeper. I love calling myself out on bullshit, you know. And I love kind of, you know, and I can tell when I'm being sloppy, and then, you know, in hindsight you get great perspective on, you know, Jesus, you know, you're so full of fucking snobbery, you know. Go back and just take, peel all the layers of paint and bullshit away from that, and I love the process of it, you know. And as I said, it's expression, like it's saved me, you know. And I'm so grateful that I can travel with it, and people get some sort of find resonance in it, you know. But if I wasn't getting the opportunities, I'd still be doing it, you know. And I know that, and I'd be doing whatever I could apply my hands to on the side, you know, to try to get by. But I'd certainly be still writing, I still have to play, you know.
Yeah.
Because there's a build up if I don't, and you know.
Yeah, it's very clear to me. One of the things I'm very keen on learning from you is that, you know, you've had the chance to live with this album for a while now. It's going to be coming out in January, is it? Yeah. I know this almost seems like a stock question, but with just considering how you write and how you live with songs, I really do wonder, like, what would you say is the song you're really keen on people hearing the most, and why? And is there a song like that for you?
On the record?
Yeah, on the record, yeah.
Um, Well, I think it's hard to say, really, but I mean, I'm interested. Like, there's no reference point on this record of me on my own with the acoustic guitar. And initially, when I came in, like, there's James Dean is on the record, and I tried to play it a few times with the acoustic, but it just nothing was happening because I'd done it, you know.
Yeah.
But I picked up the electric and it was different. And then I had done the same with another song on the record, Eastern Nights. And I was kind of happy. I was kind of satisfied by that. 'Cause I was going, okay, well, I've kind of passed that point. And it's in playing the songs live now that really interests me, because I can't really listen to the album, you know. I listened to it when I was mixing it, and then you just can't go. You can't go there with a kind of, like, you know, subjective kind of view on it. It's not happening, you know.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever heard a musician that I've talked to many. I don't think I've ever heard a musician who has said they could do that.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's it. Because you once you say it, then it's like you get it out of your system, and it's hard to go back in with any kind of. But it's in playing live that I love it. But a song like Origin of the World, I'm really interested. Maybe what people would think of that, because just in terms of there's really no. Well, for me anyway, it's a kind of this dream sequence, a kind of a stream of consciousness kind of thing. But it's a kind of a trip, that song, and it's 8 minutes long and stuff, you know. So.
Oh, nice one.
Yeah, but I mean, I just, again, it's an evolution. Beginner's Guide to Bravery, for me, it wasn't about reaching any point of enlightenment, but just to be able to map my own evolution through song over the last maybe 3 years to a point where I feel more aware of who I am and more aware of the whole and you know, trying to eradicate the fears which stop you from bearing fruit in your life, you know, and stepping into those places so that's what it is, really. Or maybe, you know, a beginner's guide. Maybe the guide is the song, you know. So it can be it's open to interpretation. I'm not even sure, you know. These things just come and they feel right, and you put it down, you know.
No, that's the way you gotta go about it. I remember a few months ago I saw your performance of Evidence of Living on the Late Late Show. For people listening might not be familiar, it's pretty much the premier late night show in Ireland. I bring that up because it's always important to bring up to artists when I feel like they've achieved a true moment, when they experienced a moment and it was a shared experience with, you know, people in a room, and, you know, nowadays with, like, things like YouTube, people from all over the world could see it. I feel like that's what that performance was, that when someone watches it, when I watched it, I very much felt like I was experiencing a moment, not just something passing me by. And yeah, just like the aspect of artistry, and I mean, I bring that up because it's kind of wild to think that artistry could exist in a format like that. Not to disparage a show at all, but just, like, the idea that you can convey artistry within the confines of, like, a late-night show. It's amazing to me. So I wonder if it felt that way for you, like, that you were pretty much the author of a moment.
Well, that's what you try to achieve, you know, for yourself first, you know. You want to kind of, as you said, be the author of that moment. That moment where that kind of, you know, time can feel stretched and slowed down, and that you can be really present, I suppose, because that's what the kind of singing of a song is. You're present in this thing, and everything else is kind of just frivolity, you know. But I suppose that was the first time we sung live. It was done live on television. And the Late Late Show is kind of this institution where, you know, my grandfather would, you know, if you get on the Late Late Show, kid, you've made it, you know. So for me, it was beautiful to play that, so he could be sitting at home watching that, or telling his mates in the pub, you know.
Yeah.
But I've had a lot of moments like that with this group of people over the last 2 years, you know. And I remember just being in this building in the last couple of years and saying to Aidan and Rachel here, you know, like, you got to get these people over here, because this is a special, it's a special collective of people, because of just the equality and the sense of community and camaraderie and the sense of, like, collective toil and everyone trying to shine a light on the next person to kind of, you know, hold them up and And they've all been gracious enough to lend their gifts into my music. And we've went on this incredible trip together in the last couple of years. And it's like this family, you know. So to be there. And I mean, I had to do that scissors kick, you know. I had to do that. I had to do that, to bring in the element of danger, you know.
Yeah.
Which is so important. Yeah, but it was a great moment, you know, and something that you can look back on. Something that your family will kind of understand, because it was in that arena of the Late Late Show, you know. Yeah.
When I heard you just now talk about your band in that way, it kind of makes me think about like how there's so many times I've talked to musicians where they kind of recognize that when they were younger, as much as they wanted to make music, because they would feel like outcasts, there's also that element of wanting to be part of a band, to kind of have that sense of camaraderie that you a lot of children sometimes feel like they don't have. Was that like that for you as a kid?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, it's like, and I probably found that sense of camaraderie in the world of song as a young kid, and in getting lost in a song or in a story, you know, and that was that sense of like being understood, you know, and that connection. I mean, that's what we do. It's to find some sort of understanding of your own psyche and subconscious, and then it's to kind of reach out and maybe grab somebody else who feels the same way. As human beings, we seek out that connection, you know. We seek out that understanding all the time in everything that we do, it's, I found that with that tribe of people, you know. And like, once you find a tribe that you can be totally free, you know, well, you have to be welcome in your own company first, but then when you can find that with other people, and it's that collective kind of, you know, collective toil and graft, it's a beautiful, it's one of the great gifts of life, you know.
Yeah, it's really amazing thing. Before I let you run here, I couldn't help but notice that you posted about the album on Instagram, and it's funny, I usually don't bring up social media stuff, it's kind of something I kind of think to myself, I was like, oh, but you said something really interesting that I knew I had to ask you about, because you wrote on Instagram that the album gifted you healing, hope, and a sense of renewal. And before we turn the recorder off, I'd love to hear you delve into what you meant by that. You've kind of touched on a lot of that over the crux of the talk, but yeah, we're just, why was it so important for you to share that with the world? Like, what does it mean to you?
Well, healing in the sense of stepping back into the headspaces that I was in when I wrote all those songs, coming from, you know, a period of life that I was, you know, coming from a place of sadness, and but the song was always that kind of element of hope, and then traveling and you know, becoming more at ease with myself through the period of the songs, you know, and through the period of the journey of the record, and self-acceptance, that's what I meant by it, you know. So the healing was in the actual, the healing was in going in and unearthing all that. Everything that had built up for years and years, you know, all your insecurities, your fears, your resentments, everything that had been building up that wasn't serving me, you know, and that was holding me back. But then I could spew it all into a song and get some sort of creative catharsis out of it. And so the whole process then was this outpouring, this continuous outpouring and stepping back into all these places, incredible highs, incredible lows. But at the end of it all, feeling a sense of, there, I've said it, and it's documented, and it's been captured on a couple of microphones, and it's there, it's living, and it's this kind of like, it's this thing that is kind of eternal now, and that will probably outlive me, you know. And with that, there's a sense of renewal, and you can walk away from it devoid of judgment, you know, and just be proud of what you've done, you know. So that's what I meant by that, and it was a gift of an experience.
Well, that's a beautiful way to cap that off. That's a beautiful thing to share with the world, and thank you for that. Before I turn off the recorder, I just need to let the world know that David Keenan is not only an amazing musician, but he could definitely win any ice staring contest in the history of the world.
12-yard stare, man. Yeah, I've got that before. But you know, you have to look someone in the eye. You know.
You do, though. You do.
You know, we're friends after all, you know. So.
Exactly.
There's no sense of being uncomfortable around you, man.
No, exactly. This is a true pleasure, honestly. Thank you, man. This is a true pleasure and a privilege to talk to you.
Likewise,
thank
you, man.
I still think about him sometimes, running my finger up its spine. Fall into a well, it left me over before my time. So I'm trying to miss this song, but on a sick back. just for you.